It'll be right here on the Head On Radio Network. You listening to the Guy James Show? See you tomorrow, gang.
Now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop, all the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting from Guy James' former microphone right here at the Take Back America Conference. And I guess I go from guest to host very quickly here. I'll tell you, as I listen to all the people that are here, progressives of every single stripe and hue, you have insiders we're going to have on later in the hour, Susie Turnbull. She's the vice chairman of the Democratic National Committee. She's number two in the Democratic Party. You can't get much more insider than that. We have outsiders. We have people doing all kinds of tactics. Sitting in front of me now is Jody Evans. She's the communications spokesperson. What are you?
Co-founder.
Excuse me. Even better. Co-founder of Code Pink. We're going to talk with her about some of her tactics. And in the middle of the hour, we've got two other people coming up. We've got sort of a standard issue lobbyist, but a good one. People for the American Way. We've got the president of that organization coming here. That's Catherine Colbert. And then also we've got John Gordonfeld. Now, he's sort of my favorite muckraking reporter. A lot of the stuff that I've broken on Reverend Sun Myung-moon, I got to admit it, much of my source or someone who directed to my sources is John Gordonfeld. So that's what's coming up today. You've got four very interesting people from inside to outside, from effective to, let's just say, using very strong tactics. I'm going to go after Jody Evans. I like her. She's sitting right here. She's so nice. I hate to be mean to her, but I think she can probably defend herself. Jody Evans, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you.
Jody, if you're speaking to the mic here so that the listeners can hear you. Now, you are a co-founder of Code Pink, and I see y'all all around. She's sitting in front of me, folks. You got to get this image on your mind. She's got this hat.
It's a pink crown.
It's a pink crown. Excuse me. It looks like it's made of plastic or styrofoam or something. It says, out of Iraq. It's got three peace signs around it. She's wearing a sash, and this great thing across it says, I miss America, which is very cute, and she's, of course, all in glorious pink. Tell me this, before we get to what's going to happen, this IRS protest, and we will get there, trust me. Tell me, you founded this organization when and why?
We founded it the day Bush put forth a resolution for a preemptive strike on Iraq to Congress. And we did three actions that day. One at 8 o'clock in the morning where we climbed up on the walls of the White House and hung a giant banner that said, no war in Iraq. We did one at the steps of Congress to talk to members of Congress about the disaster they were about to vote on. And then we disrupted the Hyde hearing, where it was actually where Bush sent it that day.
Now who are you folks? You're co-founder.
Actually three of us that day that started in a friend's living room, and it's grown to 250,000. We have 350 locals around the country. Hillary Clinton had to change her position on Iraq because every announcement speech she had when she announced her president was disrupted about her position in Iraq. We go after the pillars of war. We go after, you know, working in communities about what the community would have, how much of that community's money is sent to Iraq, and what they would have, you know, if it wasn't going for war, or we do a lot of counter-recruitment strategies so that there's less soldiers.
Now, this weekend you plan to disrupt the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service. What's the plan?
On Wednesday.
Oh, it's Wednesday. Sorry. So it's the day after tomorrow.
Actually, it's tomorrow and Wednesday.
Okay.
We will be outside of the IRS both days because about $2 trillion has already been committed to this war, and so we will visually, as we are a visible visual organization, be showing kind of what the suck of that much money looks like into war and destruction and violence, and then we'll kind of model what it looks like to come out and feed the homeless and educate people, you know, with books like Not Bombs, Healthcare Not Warfare. So we will act out in theater.
Now, Jody, all of that sounds wonderful to me. I want the troops home from Iraq. That sounds good to me. Let me tell you what some Code Pink, part of your minions were telling me, okay? That stuff that you mentioned, great. That's political protest. There's a proud American tradition. I think that's great. They said, correct me if I'm wrong, you are going to block people from entering the IRS. And this woman told me that you're going to encourage 100,000 people not to pay their taxes. Are those two things part of your program?
The 100,000 is correct, and that's a campaign that's been ongoing since the beginning of the year, which has been a call to, it's a pledge, that if I'm joined with 100,000 other people, I will not pay 7% of my taxes that goes to the war in Iraq. So it's a pledge to begin with, and if 100,000 people sign up, then those 100,000 people will follow through on that pledge. Many of the people who have pledged have since said, I don't need 100,000 people to do this, I'm going to do it anyway. Because we are so afraid of our government that the idea of that after 5 years in war, after lies, after lie, after lie, after what we've seen happen in Iraq, that people are actually afraid not to pay 7% of their taxes is pretty shameful.
Well, let me. I'm going to deal with that in a second. First of all, is it right about blocking people to enter or not? I don't know.
That's not one of our actions.
Okay,
there
that's not.
There may be another action doing that, but that's not ours.
Is it hard sometimes? I mean, it's sort of an unruly organization. I mean, you want to do one thing, and maybe some of your members want to go even farther than you. Or I mean, again, I don't need to mention this woman's name.
Sure.
But I guess that's trouble. Your organization from the beginning, Code Pink, and I see you. I go to congressional hearings. I was just, frankly, I just saw Bob Mueller of the FBI because I attend a lot of congressional hearings as part of my show to get inside information and so forth. And it seems like every time I go to a congressional hearing, there's a Code Pink person there, generally in the front row, generally lavishly and garishly in pink with crowns and everything, sitting up there. And, you know, that's great, too.
With sometimes, a message that fits that day.
But sometimes, a lot of times in those hearings, that a person will shout out in the middle of the hearing, disrupt the hearing, and get ejected. Is it part of your agenda to go a little beyond, I guess, civil discourse?
No, actually, that's not part of our agenda. Part of our agenda is to disrupt business as usual when it's all lies. So if somebody, that's how we started. At the Hyde hearing, it wasn't to disrupt the hearing. It's when we hear the lies, to disrupt the lie, to stop the, you know, kind of business as usual or the status quo and its drone of lies and say, no, that is not true. So if that looks like a disruption, it's a disruption because somebody has just said something that's not true.
So not for a lot of time for not paying your taxes. If you protest in
front of... That's actually not true. That's a myth.
Well, I mean, there are people in jail serving long sentences for not paying taxes.
For avoiding their taxes or evading taxes,
right.
But not for a political stand. There are no people in jail for taking a political stand about their taxes. If you look on our website, it tells you how to do it. I mean, and many people who've done it for the entire part of this war talk about, you know, how to do it. Gloria Steinem did it in the Vietnam War, and she talks about how you had all these writers that did it, and nothing ever happened to them. As long as you communicate what you are doing, and you're not evading or avoiding your taxes, you're filing your taxes, and you're deducting 7% and saying, I do not agree with what's happening in Iraq, I can no longer in good conscience continue to pay for it.
Okay, but if I owe $1,000 to the U.S. government and I only pay them $930 and I don't pay $70, they're going to come after me for that $70.
They will not ever put you in jail for that. There's nothing in the BAT books that say they can put you in jail for that. They're not even going to come after you because it's...
Well, that's okay. Okay, maybe I owe more money. You know, maybe I owe $10,000 and I pay $9,300 and I don't pay $700.
What they will do is they'll charge you a fine.
Right.
And interest. But they will not take you to jail.
Well, do you intend to pay those fines and interest?
Everybody gets to deal with it how they want to deal with it.
What's your plan? I hope I'm not getting you in trouble here with the IRS. What's your plan?
My plan is to continue to not pay my taxes until we're out of Iraq.
So when we're out of Iraq, then you pay back all the back fines and interest? Or?
No, I won't.
And then what happens? It builds up over time.
So that's happened over 35 years, and the people that didn't pay their taxes are still not in jail over 35 years.
See, now
one couple has gone to jail, and that's because they pushed it. One couple.
Well, when you say pushed it, you mean gone public and announce what you're doing and doing what you're doing right here on this show.
Well, no, actually, it was much stronger than that. I don't know the complete story, but there is one couple because they kept. And it was not paying all of their taxes, and it was not filing for taxes, and it was...
Because I have to tell you, just as a lawyer, I mean, the government has the right to put you in jail for not paying all of your... Particularly if it's intentional. If it's accidental, yeah, they just give you fines and all. But if you say, I'm intentionally not paying you X sum, they do have the right to put you in jail. You're just betting they won't do it.
Correct.
That's a tough bet.
Why is that a tough bet if for 35 years they haven't done it?
Well, let me ask you this.
And especially if you're talking about 100,000 people doing it together.
Can't you get your point across without breaking the law? That's the heart of my question. I mean, it
obviously,
has to do with all kinds of coping.
Obviously not.
I mean, do you think
first
this achieves anything?
First of all, okay, so this weekend, Winter Soldier took place, where for 3 days, soldiers testified about what happened in Iraq.
Right.
I have been in Iraq. I was there before. I was there after. I have known every single thing they talked about for 5 years. And even, finally, them speaking out and talking about it, nobody paid attention. So if we have to spend...
When you say nobody paid attention, do you mean
no
Congress or the government?
No Congress,
media.
No mainstream media. It is a story that is not out there unless you're watching, Democracy Now!
Why don't you tell us the story? What when you say the Winter Soldiers, what specifically?
For 3 days, soldiers that served in Iraq testified all day long about the atrocities that they themselves committed in Iraq and how it made them feel and how it dehumanized them. And they talk about the whole structure of the military. And they talked about torturing people and what happens with the Blackwater. And, they told the story that we have all known.
Which hearing, so we can get the transcript and I'll report it. You may give this to me afterwards.
I will give you all of the ways. But many of the people that testified are on therealnews.com.
Okay.
They have many of them up. They streamed it live. And I think on Democracy Now! They also were streaming it live. Maybe Free Speech TV has it archived.
I'll take a look at it. Do you remember which committee it was?
It wasn't a committee. It was 3 days of hearings.
Oh, okay.
On Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
So Congress didn't do the hearings.
No.
These are hearings.
It was to show that this all exists and Congress isn't even listening.
Why do you think that is? I mean, there are plenty of Congress that opposes the war.
Can I tell you why I'm not paying my taxes?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's not because I think that that's going to end the war. It's that I can no longer pay my taxes. And what's happened since I floated this idea is that people signed up saying, if 100,000 people don't pay, I will join them. But since even writing that much, they said, what am I waiting for? Because if you're a citizen of this country and you are watching the atrocities take place that are taking place and you don't do something, it's not, do I think it's going to happen? I have been marching. I have worked 24/7 for 5.5 years. We're still at war, but I can't not do that. For me, it's a moral question. It's I can't stand by and watch. If I'm in a hearing, and if I know hearings are taking place, and somebody is there lying, I have to be there and say this is a lie
from the very beginning. And you're willing to go to jail for that?
Before we started Code Pink, the two women at the end, we were behind Rumsfeld saying, let the inspections work. We went to Iraq to witness and come back and tell that story. We wrote 2 books about what we knew, all the things that everybody thinks they're just discovering now.
No WMDs, no connection to Al-Qaeda.
Nancy Pelosi knew that. That's why she broke with leadership and was against the war. I mean, but now all of a sudden we're not... We are creating hell on earth in Iraq. The world looks at us and laughs. But they don't really laugh. They just look in disgust.
So, I mean, the message that you give, I get it. I think actually most Americans get it. The great majority, not the great majority, but the majority of Americans do want us out of Iraq. I think most Americans feel like nothing's going to happen while this president's in office. And, yes, there will be more deaths and more destruction and more torture and everything for, 10 more months. What is it? Because what always strikes me with Code Pink or any other organizations, I mean, I remember back in the AIDS era, and you had AIDS activists that were, protesting and everything, and then you had ACT UP that was doing die-ins and the very dramatic... I take it, correct me if I mean, you get a lot of your inspiration from people like ACT UP?
I've been an activist for 35 years,
okay. You've been doing it even before then.
Yeah.
But I guess my question is...
I worked with Cesar Chavez.
Okay. When you oppose something, when should you march and call your congressman and call your congresswoman and write your letters and protest legally, responsibly, but do so, protest. And when should you disrupt? In your view, what's the distinction?
Everybody has to do what they do. Everybody has to do what they see is needed. It's not like there's a should and a shouldn't. If someone is so moved to scream out in the middle of a meeting that you think they should be behaving in, which is what you're talking about, they need to scream out, because we're all behaving. And while we're behaving and being good, atrocities are happening. So for some people, they look at that and they can't shut up.
I'll tell you though, when I look at the IRS...
And you're talking about effectiveness. Let's talk about where the effectiveness
okay.
is.
Okay.
So you're looking at effective like that you're going to get the war to end.
Yeah, that's your goal.
As an activist, your goal always is to affect the person closest to you. And as you affect the person closest to you, as the anti-war movement has grown, it has changed public opinion so that everybody was for going to war, now they're for getting out. And that took an anti-war movement constantly standing up and convincing the next person to stand up in their way.
But can't you have an anti-war movement that is marching, that is protesting, that isn't going further and breaking the law? Look at the IRS, for example. These are a bunch of functionaries. These are tax people. Your argument is with Congress. Your argument is with the president. They're the ones who got us in the war, not a bunch of tax people sitting in their offices in Washington.
But Congress isn't listening. We elected...
So why aren't you doing more stuff in Congress?
You just said you see us at every hearing.
Well, that's true. But I mean... people's
because
offices...
Because when we notice that Congress isn't listening and that they're, just weak-spined and that they're not going to do anything for the rest of this term, then we have to go other places and show, look, what we're doing is in front of the IRS... showing the rest of the country that all their money is going into this place, it's going to where 51% of their taxes goes to fund military, while in their community, things are suffering. We become the visual that tells the story.
You can't do the visual without the... I mean, you could do everything, the pink and the hat and attend the hearings.
I just told you, the plan is to be on outside of the IRS.
Free to do whatever you want to do.
There will be other activists, I'm sure, in town... that'll be pushing it as far as they can. Activists that have been in this anti-war movement for 5.5 years and they're at the 5-year mark of a war, I'm sure on Wednesday we're going to see a lot of things, because there is probably every anti-war group in town doing different tactics.
Let's say we have a Democratic senator elected. I won't say which one, but Obama or Clinton, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And he or she becomes president, and a year later our troops are out of Iraq. What happens to Code Pink? You'll still be there, right? Protesting other warlike actions, I assume?
We'll still have a military budget that's taking away from education and health care, and I think that's a fantasy that you have that I would love to buy into, and I would love to retire. So,
No. I'm not saying we'd get out of all war. We won't. But let me ask you, the war in Iraq, I think, is easy. At least for me, it's easy, because the country didn't attack us.
We would like to end violence against women and girls in the world.
Can you sometimes end violence with violence? And I'll give you the example. The example is the Taliban. Was the worst toward women of any government in the world. Saudi Arabia was second.
No, that's not true. Actually, the warlords were worse, and the women of Afghanistan didn't want the Taliban taken out because the warlords were worse than the Taliban.
Well, in terms of being required to wear full-body burqas and so forth.
So, I'm just telling you, the women of Afghanistan preferred the Taliban to the warlords.
All the women of Afghanistan?
Most of them.
Have you been to Afghanistan?
Yes, I have.
And that's what people have told you? Well, I'll tell you, Jody, we may not agree on your tactics, but I'll tell you this. I have a lot of respect for who you are and what you do as an American fighting the cause. I believe in many of the things you believe in. I'm just probably not going to break the law to do it, but you do,
right.
And that's okay. I guess what I'm trying to say is we may disagree on tactics,
right.
But we're on the same
everybody's
side.
Everybody's got to do what they got
to
do. What you're doing, and I do what
absolutely.
I do.
Absolutely. That's why I come on the air.
Right.
To let people like you have a voice and
we
to
appreciate that.
Give people who are left out a voice. Thank you very much for coming on the Inside Scoop. I appreciate that. Well, I hope you found that interesting. I know I did. She's a very strong-willed person, obviously. She's sitting across from me, very intense and clearly very determined, and certainly I was not going to dissuade her in any way, but it's interesting to find out what she was all about. Coming up right now, I have, shall I say, a more conventional activist. I hope you don't take that as an insult. This is Catherine Colbert. She's the president of People for the American Way. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks, Mark. It's nice to be here.
Now, I'm going to do a comparison.
But
because
I hate being called conventional.
Well, like I said, I didn't want to insult you. I actually see that as a plus because, in my view, and this is part of the argument I just had with Jody Evans, when you break the law, which is what Code Pink believes in, and disrupt hearings and get arrested and so forth.
Well, here's what I agree. Yes, we're not out there breaking the law, but we're going to be feisty and out there fighting for the rights of all Americans, and that means we're going to do so in a variety of very, very vigorous ways.
How are you feisty? Now, many of my listeners have just heard a very powerful presentation by Code Pink. How is People for the American Way, how are you going to be feisty in getting changes? What are you going to be up to?
Well, the first thing we're going to do, and let me just start by saying I started the job this morning, so I haven't been on it for very long. But
today's your first day. And already people are attacking you. What
Absolutely.
Do you know?
But the first thing I'm going to spend my attention on over the next several months is to really focus on the 2008 election and to make the Supreme Court of the United States an issue in this election because the Supreme Court is on the ballot. Whatever we may think that we're only electing a president, we're also electing the person who has the potential of changing the legacy of this court over the next 30 years.
Here's the thing, Catherine. I have such sympathy for your view. I am a lawyer. I'm a constitutional lawyer. I know the power of the Supreme Court. I came to Washington because in 2000 the Supreme Court was choosing my president, and I kind of thought that we the people should choose the president. I have extreme sympathy for your position, but here comes the big but. I talk about the Supreme Court all the time. I talk about the president matters, and I got to tell you, I'm talking with Americans that are not lawyers,
Mark?
And they talk about Iraq and the economy and all these things
the
are
right
important.
The right wing gets it.
Yeah, they sure
Trust
do.
Trust me.
They
the
sure
right
do.
Wing gets it. It doesn't have to be a lawyer. The right wing gets
they
it.
They sure do.
They
Alito
are
and
out there pushing John McCain from day one. They understand what's at stake. We just need to do a better job explaining ourselves.
Well,
and
now,
I think
the right wing does get it. I mean, in these battles.
Because they've worked at it for 20 years. They had a strategy 20 years ago to take over the court. I spent my career, Mark, fighting for the rights of women.
Your career? Why don't you tell our listeners?
Well, what I did is I represented abortion clinics and Planned Parenthood versus Casey and a variety of other cases before the Supreme Court, protecting a woman's right to choose.
That's in real jeopardy if John McCain becomes president.
Absolutely is in real jeopardy if John McCain becomes president.
We have five bare votes for Roe v. Wade with Kennedy maybe hanging on the edge. If they get one more,
it's gone.
John Paul Stevens
it's already
is 80,
in jeopardy.
What, 85?
86.
86 years old. And and he's my hero. May he live a very, very long life.
And he's doing his best to do what's right.
How can he survive another four-year term? I mean, he's appointed by Gerald Ford. The irony is he's appointed by a Republican president back when the Republicans weren't as radical as they are now. How do you convey if the right wing gets it, you got your job cut out for you.
I do. But I think what people have to understand is this court, even though Chief Justice Roberts came out and looked as moderate as can be.
He sure tried.
They are wolves in sheep's clothing.
Give me some examples.
Well, for example, the Lilly Ledbetter case. This was a case involving a woman who was suing for sex discrimination in her job. She was paid less than men in her job. The lower federal courts looked at the evidence and said
and
she
it was like
to
for
win.
A decade or something, right?
Yeah, or more.
20 years.
20 years, but she didn't know about it. And you know what that court said? The court said you need to file within 180 days of when the change occurred, even if you didn't know it was discrimination at the time.
Right, so basically if they slip you the knife and you don't see them coming, you can't sue. You can only sue if you see them coming.
Right. And here's the problem, which is they have done a variety of things, like in that case, to slam the courthouse door on the little people. And to me, that is really the despicable part of this court. They're doing things in ways that we as lawyers understand, but effectively keep people from exercising their rights and keep people from going to courts and being and using the courts as the guardians of their liberty.
So how do we see? My listeners know this. My listeners are very sophisticated people. They know this.
I know they do, and that's why they're going to come join People for the American Way, right?
They do. But in terms of a lot of people who are working, you know, 2-3 jobs, and they're struggling with the economy and the mortgage crisis, and they definitely want our troops home from Iraq, and they want health care, and all these issues, none of which I'm knocking. They're all very strong issues. What I guess people don't understand is that the Supreme Court is in all those issues, whether it's the president torturing people or health care or just discrimination.
There is not an issue in America that won't eventually come to the lower federal courts and the Supreme Court at some point.
And yet we talk about Congress. We talk about getting elected. We definitely talk about the presidential race. There's nothing else to talk about. The Supreme Court is wrapped in this sort of mystery. What can People for the American Way do to let people know about the Ledbetter case? Are you going to be running ads in this presidential season?
We're going to be running ads in the presidential season. We've taken we're targeting in particular senatorial districts. Maine, New Hampshire, Minnesota, and Oregon are on our top tier. And we're going
Well, that's good. You're going to win New Hampshire. I'm convinced of that. Maine's going to be tough. Minnesota, you're going to win.
You know, Maine's a really good example. Here is Susan Collins, who has been, you know, arguably pro-choice. She says she's pro-choice. She's voted right on a variety of bills. She is what's known as a moderate Republican.
She is known that way.
All right. But what happens? The most critical vote, who's on the Supreme Court?
And she votes
supports the party line and supports Alito and Roberts. Now, we can't afford in the next 4 years to have a Senate that is not 100% with us, or at least 60 votes with us on the Supreme Court, and that's why we've targeted these particular races.
Now, the People for the American Way was begun by Norman Lear in, what,
1981, 25 years old.
Wow, it's 25 years old
Jordan.
Already. And Barbara Jordan, really.
And the president of Notre Dame.
She was a founder as well.
So, I mean, it has a long and illustrious history.
What would you say? I mean, I can think of a whole bunch of liberal principles that you support, but what would you say is the animating, I don't know, if you had to give a mission statement or something, what can you sum up everything you stand for in a few words? Because some would argue that, for example, abortion shouldn't be part of the progressive agenda. There are people who are pro-life and yet support progressives on the environment and economic issues and disagree on abortion. How do you define your agenda?
Well, we do two things. We protect civil rights and civil liberties, the most basic ones that are part of our constitutional heritage, freedom of speech, protection for religious tolerance, protection for basic rights for criminal defendants and other Americans, support for racial justice.
Bill of Rights, Constitution.
The Constitution.
You're a strict constructionist liberal. That's what I like to hear. I need more of those.
We are proudly liberal. There is no doubt about that, and we are going to be out there being proudly liberal. The other thing we do is we promote American values. And so we're not just working.
Well, American values. Now, the right says they have American values.
They certainly do, but they're not the values that we support. And I think that the important thing is there's no counter to that right wing in America anymore. And People for is out there doing that. The right wing understood that you make public policy in legislatures and in Congress, but you change people's minds in culture. And that's what People for does really, really
well.
How
do you affect the culture? I mean, All in the Family, that was Norman Lear,
that was
right?
Norman Lear.
And that was very well done. But what are you doing culturally? That's a great question,
apart
from politically.
You know, I've been on the job one day, but
what have you done in the last 3 hours?
Today.
You haven't done anything, Catherine, in your entire time as president of People for the American Way. You haven't done a single cultural thing.
In a year. We are going to be out there culturally.
What are you going to do?
Well, I'm going to talk to people who are writing TV's shows and movies.
You can do that?
I can do that.
So is Hollywood part of the liberal, secret liberal agenda then?
It is. And you know what? When people say the liberals are taking over America, we're the people they're most worried about. And I'm proud to be there, because the point is we need to be feisty about the America we want. And that is one that respects privacy, that respects freedom of speech, that respects religious diversity, that believes in racial justice, that believes in opportunity for all. These are things that are purely American that we ought to be proud of, and we ought to be out there vigorously defending those values.
Now, when you talk about culture, you said we got TV shows. What else? I mean, let me ask you this, for example. Can the culture go too far? There's a lot of criticism, for example, of rap music lyrics, which is supposed to be Hollywood and free speech, with things you support. But let's face it, there's misogyny, they talk about killing cops. I mean, is there any limit? How far does it go?
Well, my position is free speech says you argue against those things with free speech,
okay.
Right?
So you speak out against them, but you don't ban them.
I'm not for misogyny. I'm not for rap lyrics that are harmful to kids. But the point is that they have the right to say it, and we have the right and the obligation to protest it as well, and that's what freedom of speech is all about.
So in the next 7 months, first of all, I assume you haven't taken a position on Clinton versus Obama. Is that right?
No, and we will not.
But you will support the Democratic nominee in the fall.
We will support the Democratic nominee in the fall.
So right. Does that mean that you sort of
laying low now? You know, John McCain is when it comes to judges, he is out there as right-wing as you can get. He is supporting...
What do we know? How can we know about John McCain and judges? What can we know?
Well, we know what he said.
What's he
and
said?
And he said he will support judges like Alito and Roberts. Okay, he is crawling in bed with right-wing ideologues.
Now, he didn't used to do that, right? In 2000, he called Jerry Falwell agents of intolerance, Pat Robertson. He's flip-flopped on that, which
he
is the true John
out there
McCain.
The true John McCain is he wants to solidify the right-wing base, and what do they say? They want him to appoint judges who are supportive of their ideological position, and John McCain seems to be crawling in bed with them very, very quickly.
How many new judges will the next president appoint? What do you think?
At least one, maybe more. Could be as many as three. And
is one judge enough to overturn
Roe
v. Wade?
Well, absolutely. But more importantly, the next president also has the right to appoint lower federal court judges who make a difference. Remember, we have a Supreme Court right now that takes very few cases a year. 118 is the average in the last two terms that they've taken. That's very, very, very few cases. That means most law is being decided by the lower federal courts, and the Republicans, 3-1, have nominated more judges in the lower federal courts. We need somebody there who's going to reverse that trend.
I want to ask you about the filibuster, because it's amazing sometimes who's on which side. I remember back in the 90s, you had people like Orrin Hatch saying, no, you have to get a blue slip. If both state senators oppose this person, you can't put them in. And then, of course, Bush came and they threw out that rule and said, no filibustering, no majority rule. And now, if we get a Democratic president, I don't know, they might support a filibuster again. Has your organization taken a position on the right to filibuster with regard to judges, and how can you be consistent about it when the Republicans, with the Republicans want a filibuster, the Democrats don't?
Our position is consistent with fair rules, and that's been a rule in Congress for a long time. I think we do support the right to filibuster. And
now you've got a Democratic president, are you still going to support
it? It shouldn't matter. And this is why the Constitution is so valuable and important. It shouldn't matter who's in power. What should matter is that the process is fair, and that the institutions that we are trying to protect really do their job. And one of the reasons that the courts is high on our priority list is because that balance, the checks and balances between the three branches of government, has gone so far askew that the president has lots of power and Congress and the courts have lost their ability to be good checks on that power.
Okay.
And that's really what we're
talking about. But you had the Gang of 12 or Gang of 14, and they said, in effect, we will vote as a bloc, half Democrats, half Republicans, and therefore basically not allow a filibuster. So when you had a Republican president, George Bush, there weren't filibusters. Alito and Roberts got in. Now, if we switch to a Democratic president,
isn't it fair that the same Gang of 14
play by the same rules? Because I don't want a filibuster.
Let me tell you, that's
president.
Why we think it's so important to elect a Senate with 60 votes that's going to be able to overcome that effort. I'm not against the filibuster generally, but what I do think is we ought to have 60 Democrats in that Senate so that they can support a Democratic president's position.
I think we can get 56, 57. I don't know about 60.
Well, you know, never say never. And we are not going to win if we don't try. And I think that this year is unlike any year we've ever seen. We're going to have more people coming out to vote. If young people are there saying they care about the Supreme Court, we've never seen the likes of how many young people could turn out to vote. I think it's a whole new ballgame.
So where can people find out more about the People for the American Way?
Well, People for the American Way is online at pfaw.org. I urge you to come and become a member, join up, and help us win this fight.
Catherine Corbett, thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, that's two down, two to go. I am waiting for my third guest to show up. But there he is. He's hanging out there. Maybe someone can actually grab him. Hey, Catherine, grab that nice young man with the glasses over there and tell him I'm ready for him. That's how it is on live radio, folks. We've just got to grab people while we can. Oh, he's walking off. There he is. This is John Gorenfeld. I'm about to introduce you. Now, John, I'm a big fan of John. John's about, I don't know, 10 years younger than me, maybe even younger. I don't know. How old are you, John? 33? See, I thought you were younger. John is an amazing thing because he's a young investigative reporter. I tell you, there are not too many around doing the kind of muckraking that he's doing. A lot of people, let me tell you know what it is on the blogs. You know what they do. They go, they find a really cool article, they post it on their blog, and they say, this is journalism, right? Well, you know, I don't mind passing around good articles. That's good. That's fair. That's a good thing to do. But someone who merely goes out there, finds some article someone else wrote, and posts it on their blog, you know, that's, let's just call that low-level journalism. John Gorenfeld does high-level journalism, and it's one of the reasons why I'm very glad to have you here on the Inside Scoop. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Mark.
Yeah, now you've been on my show four times before, speaking to the microphone while you're
here. Yeah, am I close enough here? Yeah, about three times. I think the Reverend Moon story goes back to starting out on your show, actually.
That's right. We were the first to talk about when Reverend Sun Yung Moon got crowned in a Senate office building with a crown on a pillow, Danny Davis presenting it to him, and then it later made it into Salon and then the Washington Post, I think.
It was all over. It was on The Daily Show.
Right.
And the New York
Times. And
Times
I didn't
editor.
Get any credit for it. And
yeah,
you did, I think, a little, I hope.
I needed to give you more credit for that. I really do. It really. I remember it very clearly being an Inside Scoop exclusive.
It was.
At the time.
It was.
And was slow to catch on. But basically, this was this ceremony where this notorious 1970s madman who, unbeknownst to 99% of Americans, publishes the conservative newspaper, the Washington Times, announced that he had become a divine being on Capitol Hill in the presence of your elected officials.
Well, let's back up here because most people, I think, know who Reverend Sun Yung Moon is, but there may be a few that don't. He's been around forever, since the 70s, 80s. He's his
60s.
He's an extremely wealthy Korean billionaire. I don't know where he got his money. Do you know that? You must. You know everything.
It's very
about
murky
him.
How the Reverend Moon got his money, but there is a lot of it. The best-known source of his money is enslaving teenagers, basically, in the 70s and getting them to sell flowers on street corners for him.
Some of you older folks may remember that, people coming up to you in this sort of crazed look on their face and selling you a flower. He has declared himself the Messiah.
Right.
He says he talks to Jesus and Hitler.
And dead presidents.
And dead presidents. Now, that's not the dead presidents, the group.
No, not the dead presidents or the dead presidents soundtrack.
Okay.
We're talking about 36 different dead presidents. He actually takes out full-page newspaper ads claiming that everyone from George Washington to Nixon, who actually knew him in real life before passing away, that all of these people have somehow endorsed him as the Messiah. And George Washington says, I, George Washington, am deeply moved to learn the identity of the Messiah, Reverend Moon, and I'm sad that humanity isn't paying attention to him. Basically.
I just don't see George doing that. I just, you know, I mean,
he's
I just don't think
character.
I don't think his wooden teeth would clack that way. But it's amazing how a man like this has such influence over our political system. Let's just give a few more crazy things out there so people know how wild and mad this guy is. He is busy taking the crosses down from churches and replacing them with crowns.
Well, basically, the Reverend Moon has a real problem with Christianity as we know it. And one of the people that he talks to from beyond the grave is Jesus. He claims that Jesus is impatient and is sad that humanity hasn't recognized Moon as the Messiah instead of Jesus, whom Reverend
Moon... Now, is Moon and Jesus the Messiah? Does he at least share it with Jesus,
or
is he the replacement?
He sees Jesus as a carpenter who turned in substandard contracting work. To him, the message is that Jesus, it was a nice try... But that moon is here to complete the picture. And why this isn't a major scandal to Christians across the country that this guy publishes the Republican newspaper is...
Well, and we're going to get to that, but just so we're clear, he pays ministers, mostly in poor African-American churches, to take the cross down from the church and replace it with a crown.
This is something he did on Easter 2003. He actually went so far as to send out a funeral procession for the cross. A funeral party was dispatched to Jerusalem. A number of Moonies and people that they were able to bring into this cause. And there's actually photographs on this that they posted on the web because they're so proud of it, of digging a shallow grave, taking a big cross and burying it there. And the symbolism was that Reverend Moon was now the Messiah. And making this even weirder was that members of Congress put the stamp of government approval on this wacky,
how did they do
blasphemous
that?
Idea. Well, by on March 23rd, 2004, there was this reception put on for the Reverend Moon, arranged by a very important member of the religious right, a lobbyist named Gary Jarman, who as long ago as the late 70s, before the rise of Falwell and all these people, was profiled on 60 Minutes as the crest of the new wave of the religious right, this powerful new force. Anyway, these religious right people arranged for the Reverend Sun Myung Moon to parade around on Capitol Hill in a Senate office building wearing a shiny crown and robes, and he gave a speech about being the Messiah. And
well, here's what the reason why Congress is toting up to this guy is because, well, there are lots of reasons. One is he has the second largest newspaper in Washington. Now, to be fair, the Washington Post has, I guess, 90% of the market, and the Washington Times has maybe 10%, if that.
And now there's the Examiner, of course, but the Examiner is in a different category. The Washington Times has a really special role because of how widely it's quoted as a sounding board for conservative stories.
Well, Tony Snow came from the Washington Times. Our press secretary came from the Moonie newspaper.
You know, a wide variety of major conservative media figures did their training time at the Washington Times under this man, Sun Myung Moon, who is considered every parent's worst nightmare circa about 1980.
Okay, so just so we get it straight, he has given a lot of money to a lot of members of Congress.
Well, not directly to members of Congress, Mark. What the Reverend Moon specializes in doing is building up campaign groups. When George H.W. Bush was running, the Reverend Moon dumped millions of dollars into a fake grassroots organization, the American Freedom Coalition. They staged pro-Gulf War rallies. The Reverend Moon has always stayed a little bit out of sight by not giving directly to politicians, but by giving enormous gifts such as the Washington Times newspaper, which is a $3 billion gift out of the pockets of this foreign church that has subsidized these free market conservatives.
Now, hasn't he given money to the ex-president, George Bush Sr.?
Oh, actually, yeah. Okay, I should qualify that. Yeah, well, the Bushes have their own special pattern of taking money from Reverend Moon.
Does the current president take money from Moon?
Absolutely. The current George W. Bush took $250,000 for his inaugural from a Unification Church-owned business. That's the Unification Church, is Reverend Moon's religion.
Now, did he know it was a Unification Church business?
Nobody really asked him, but it followed doing a few favors for Reverend Moon, like sending congratulations to one of his events, and this shows up in the Reverend Moon's paper in December of 2004. That
George Bush is supposed to be such a good Christian.
Right. Well, he's inherited the strange duty of having to keep the money flowing from his father's rather odd friend. And George.
Well, let's talk about his father. Yeah, what did he do?
George H.W. Bush has probably the most notable relationship of any politician with Moon. And this was in the wire services. This was right out there, and barely anybody really noticed it. But in the mid-90s, to raise at least $1 million in speaking fees, George H.W. Bush literally went on tour with the Reverend Moon Roadshow, going to Buenos Aires, going to Japan.
Did he go with Reverend Moon?
Yeah, he didn't share the same jet. He went separately, but he shared a stage with the Reverend Moon.
Really?
And in Japan, this was particularly despicable because at the time...
Do you have pictures? I mean, you got video?
Yeah, there's
YouTube?
Actually a video footage that was on the BBC a few years back, and
you have to send it to me. I'll post it on my website.
Yeah, it's literally George H.W. Bush standing up there saying, Reverend Moon is the man with the vision behind the Washington Times. He never has interfered editorially, never told them what to say, what to do.
Is that true?
I don't think it's true at all because, well, as we know, you can work for a corporation, and just because they don't directly tell you what to say or what not to say doesn't mean you're not influenced by them. And in the case of the Washington Times, which takes a lot of pride in being independent, supposedly, from this cult, they've run a number of plugs in the pages of the Washington Times for these wacky, frightening events put on by Sun Myung-moon, who has this obsession with the United Nations and the idea that he should be in charge of the United Nations. Well, you open up the Washington Times, and every now and then, they've printed these plugs where they'll say, you know, clerics at the United Nations are demanding major changes around here, and that this new religious organization be brought into the United Nations. And it's all a joke. And in my book, in talking to
yeah, tell us about your book. What's
well,
the name of your
book? My book is called Bad Moon Rising. What I was going to say, though, is that there's some evidence that people in the Washington Times have privately considered it a joke that they're separate from this, from the Unification Church, which pays their bills, but they all know that they're there as a promotional device for the Reverend Sun Myung-moon, who's got an enormous amount of prestige out of this.
John, let me ask you this. It's always fun to talk about sex on the radio, and there's certainly a lot of it with Reverend Sun Myung-moon. Not only does he gather up, I guess, thousands of people who've never met and have mass marriages on the day they meet, but there's a certain practice. Don't get too literal here, but tell us what the holy handkerchief is about.
Oh,
please.
That old one. Yeah, well, this is really interesting because this is the kind of kinky stuff you do not expect to find in the same circles as Jerry Falwell, who took $3.5 million from Moon. And these folks and some of the founding fathers of the religious right, all these people that are so quick to denounce heresies. Well, the Reverend Moon's central teaching, and what was so visible back in the sort of what I would call the classic Moon era of the mass weddings, was his obsession with the idea that human beings must be purified by him personally to undo the taint of the Garden of Eden.
Moon's going to end original sin.
Moon is going to end original, exactly.
Himself. Wow. He's got to get around a lot. I mean, there's a lot of human beings on this planet.
There's procedures here that Reverend Moon has developed, painstaking procedures, in order that when you have sex, it will be, first of all, with a spouse chosen for you by Moon.
Well, of course. You wouldn't want to have sex with an unapproved spouse. I mean,
right.
that would be like, you know, I don't know, going to baseball with an unapproved bat. I mean, that would be wrong. Go ahead.
No, you need the Moon seal of approval.
Moon seal of approval.
Or else all other marriages to Moon are satanic. So
right.
You go to the stadium.
Satanic. So,
absolutely.
So 99.9999% of marriages on Earth are satanic. Okay.
Moon has this terrifically paranoid Moon versus the world versus Satan, I should say, view. He's even showed up at the Washington Times and ranted about how Satan hates Reverend Moon and the whole world has opposed me. But getting back to the sex.
Yes. Please, get back to the sex, John.
You're standing in this big, it almost looks like a hall of a wedding in a hall of mirrors. People with tuxes and wedding gowns stretching to the edge of the stadium. And Moon has picked out somebody for you. You're, of course, exhausted out of your mind from months of selling for Reverend Moon on the streets 18 hours a day.
And you don't get protein, is
yeah,
that right?
Yeah, one of the ideas is that, if you go without food and sleep, it's been proven that you can buy into a lot of things that you might not otherwise.
It's a great way to get someone in your cult. Listen, folks, if you ever want to declare yourself as a Messiah, just take all your listeners, deny them food and sleep and protein, and they will sell flowers for you and anything you want. So in case you ever want to be that creepy Messiah, here Moon has given you the path. But go ahead, please.
No, I mean, it's a classic playbook of the 20th century, 21st century cult.
Right.
So anyway, so here you are, and you're not allowed to have sex until after Moon says it's okay. There's a real control over his followers' sex lives. And when they do finally...
So you've just gotten married to this complete stranger,
right.
And then you have to wait several...
You have to be off on missionary duty for a while before you're able to consummate with them, because you're still pushing...
I don't think I want to join this cult, but go ahead.
So the thing is that after you come back and you meet up, before the night of consummation, there's something called the indemnity stick ceremony. One of the second to top editors of the Washington Times, Josette Scheiner, had to go through this, and it was hit so hard that. Well, the idea.
Wait, what is the indemnity stick? Who's hitting what?
It's a very holy kind of spanking.
A holy spanking?
In which there's a stick, almost like a kendo stick.
A what stick?
Kendo, sort of like Japanese martial arts. And you have to take this stick, the idea is to beat Satan out of the other person.
Oh, my God.
To make sure that Satan's completely gone. So you hit the person. The man hits the woman first, I believe. There's some logic behind that having to do with the original sin.
Is there bleeding?
No, but supposedly people have writhed around in pain after that. It's not pleasant.
Okay, so you hit your wife with a stick, all right.
Yeah,
and then what? Another pleasant thing. You deny yourself sex for months, no protein, no sleep. You hit your wife with a stick.
Right.
This sounds like so much fun, John. I just can't. Okay, and then what?
We're now at the honeymoon period. So now that there's the honeymoon, you then... you're provided with a number of special supplies for the consummation.
Ah, the holy handkerchief is coming up.
One of them is the holy handkerchief. One of them is a supply of holy wine. And in fact, this is very strange because I, in fact, have video of Moody leaders claiming that they visited the George H.W. Presidential Library at Texas A&M University. They claim that they brought some of this holy wine and convinced George H.W. Bush to drink it. It's sort of their communion.
Well, I hope they have YouTube of it, because that would be great.
There is a YouTube of it. I will send it
to
you.
Of Bush drinking?
Yeah, it'll be an exclusive.
No,
I'm sorry. Not of him drinking, but of the president of the American Unification Church boasting about getting him to drink this. But we're getting away
from
this.
Please send it. Yeah, get away. I got to get back to the holy handkerchief. Come on, John. My listeners are waiting to hear about the holy handkerchief.
You have the holy handkerchief, you have the wine, you have some sort of bowl, you have a candle, you have a picture.
A bowl? What?
Yeah, I think the wine goes into the bowl. I've got to double
check. A bowl? I thought you said a bowl. Okay.
And a photograph of Reverend Moon looking on.
Ah, nice.
So it's under his watchful eye.
Nice.
And you have sex three different nights in three different positions, symbolizing Adam and Eve. And at the end, the man regains
sexual...
his superior position. At the beginning, the woman... it has the sort of supremacy.
I see. So it's all about man taking over supremacy from woman.
It has to do with taking back
what Eve took away. After you beat the woman, you got to be supreme over her. This is a great religion, folks.
It's very wholesome. And Moon's slogan is that there's a secret in the Bible that you never heard about until Moon. And his secret is that man, quote unquote, misused the love organ. And so to get up at conservative events...
I don't think I want to ask about using the love organ.
I have lots of videotape where Moon will actually get up in front of respectable audiences and start talking about the love organs and how... But so anyway, the holy handkerchief is used to cleanse yourself after the act.
To preserve the sexual fluid.
To preserve, yes. And you're supposed to... this is almost a direct quote. You're supposed to hang it up. Put it somewhere where it won't be laundered by accident, and keep it for the rest of your life.
John, we've got to go soon, but just to close up here, tell us very quickly in just a couple minutes about how much money Moon has funded some of the right wingers we know, Falwell, Robertson.
Millions and millions and millions of dollars. I mean, there's a very serious side to all of this lunacy, and that is that people that I've found, there's almost a 2 degrees of separation, 3 degrees, once you start looking into the people who were the founding fathers of modern-day conservatism. So many people have ties to Moon that it's astonishing. In fact, before people's kids were getting sucked into the Moonies, a guy named Richard Viguerie, who was the founding funder of the Reagan Revolution.
Right, absolutely.
He was I found a letter from 1965 from Richard Viguerie to Reverend Moon's second in command talking about doing mail order stuff.
John,
together.
I need to have you back
and
a lot sooner than later. I'd love to have you back for a full hour. Tell us all these details in your book and give us not just the lunacy of Reverend Sun Young Moon, but all of his complete ties to the Bush family, to the religious right. Will you come on my show
and
do that?
That's the good part. Yeah, I would love to.
Terrific. We will have you on, folks. I promise you. I will get John Gorenfeld on, maybe even next week. But I got to go on. I got another guest. Thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop. My guest coming up right now is the second highest person in the Democratic Party, right? After Howard Dean, the vice chairman of the Democratic National Committee, is someone who doesn't get quite as much press as Howard Dean does. Her name is Susie Turnbull. She's been on the Inside Scoop before. And while Howard Dean is taking all the flack from everyone, she's the one who's actually getting the work done, I suspect, behind the scenes. Susie Turnbull, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, great to be with you.
Well, you know what everybody's talking about. They're talking about Michigan, they're talking about Florida, and they're saying that the National Party messed it up. Or maybe the state parties messed it up. I don't know. A lot of Democrats are mad at each other. What happened with Michigan and Florida? How do we end up in this mess, and how do we get out of it?
Okay, well, first of all, I don't know if it's necessarily a mess. I think it's something that's going to be worked out. I think that what we have to look forward to is that we've got other contests coming up. Between now and June, those contests are going to be resolved, and we're going to have a nominee in June.
So we are going to have a redo.
I don't know if we're necessarily going to have a redo. I think that it's likelier that there is a quote-unquote redo in Michigan, where not every candidate was on the ballot, so we actually have a do.
Well, you got to have one there,
you
right?
got to have a do before you have a redo.
Sure.
And in Florida, it looks like the mail ballot won't work. And so the states have two options. They come up with a new plan, or they between now and June, or they take it to the floor, to the credentials committee of the convention. Those are their only two options.
Let me back up here before we go too much further, because many of us know the basic issue. Okay, Michigan and Florida won't be counted. They had their primaries earlier than they should have because the Democrats' national committee said, except for four states, you got to go on February 5th or later. But how did, organically, how did we get to this moment? I mean, what really happened?
How we got to this is we had 5 years where we had, over 5 years ago, the then chairman of the DNC put together a commission after, well, actually not 5 years ago, 4 years ago, after the...
Who was that, by the way?
Terry McAuliffe.
Okay.
After the November 2004 election, put together a commission to look at how to do what our primary and caucus system should be for the next nominating cycle. Okay, great. We did that. We had representatives from across the country. We all met. Everyone approved it, and they came up with a program where you'd have these four states to bring diversity to our contests, different kinds of big state, little state, north, south, east, and west. So we all agreed to that, okay? And that February 5th was then going to be the first date that would be available after those first January primaries.
What became Super Tuesday?
What became Super Tuesday. 18 months ago, everyone agreed to the schedule.
Did Michigan and Florida Democrats agree?
Michigan, Florida, everyone agreed. It was a unanimous decision.
Really? So what happened?
So what happened is time went on. The Florida legislature started playing around.
Okay, but the Florida legislature, they're Republican. The governor's
absolutely.
Republican. I can understand why Florida would want to throw a wrench in the Democratic Party. I think they did it on purpose. The way they have the Saturday before the Tuesday of Super Tuesday, so they did it by 3 days just to throw a mess into the process. Okay, but why did Michigan, Governor Granholm, a good Democrat, that I don't get.
I think, basically, Michigan felt that there should be a state that had a greater labor influence and also greater diversity. And so, in fact, that's what they plan to do, and that's what they did. But you know what? We can't recreate history at this point, Mark. What we have to do is move forward. And what we need to do as a party is to make sure that we have a candidate that has a united Democratic Party behind him or her to move forward. And that we need to keep our eye on the real ball, and what we really need to talk about is John McCain.
Well, okay, and I will get to him, I promise, and we got about 4 minutes left, so we will have time to deal with him. But first, it sounds to me like you're saying that Michigan is a done deal. That will definitely be done over. Is that fair?
I don't know.
90%?
I can't say that. I think it's very likely that some kind of action is going to take place.
Primary, caucus, mail-in, you don't know.
I don't know for sure.
But you think that's going to happen
based on the
quiet conversations that folks like you have and Howard Dean and everyone else.
I think it's fairly public. I mean, a lot of people have been seeing this in the newspaper and on TV and radio and all over Michigan.
Who's going to pay for it?
And I think that's the one thing that's going to happen out there, that there's got to be some decision. Someone just suggested something to me. You could do, a tax on the media ads that are out there. There's ways to get around this, and there's ways that can happen. And I think that it's going to be up to the people in Michigan to present a plan to the DNC, and the DNC can decide whether or not it's going to work.
So you think it's going to happen in Michigan. You sound less optimistic about Florida.
Partially because one of the plans, their original plan was to come forward with a mail-in ballot.
Right, right.
And
why
the problem
was that
is that there's a law in Florida currently preventing that type of situation, and you'd have to.
You couldn't change
too
the
much
law.
Time to
so would we count
it.
The Florida results that Hillary Clinton won, even though he didn't campaign down there? What do you think?
No, I think that there's going to. It got to be some concession made in recognition to the fact that these results are not are from an invalid election.
But
and
we can't
what we
not
need to
count
do
Florida,
is,
can we? I mean, after this history of 2000, can we tell Florida they don't
I
count
think that, that what I'm saying is that there's got to be some sort of accommodation made to recognize the voters of Florida.
Right.
And but at the same time, what you've got to do is make sure that it is equitable and fair to the other 48 states that filed the rules.
We only got 2 minutes left. I know you want to talk about John McCain, so go ahead. Last
okay.
2 minutes. Tell us
here's
why
John
he's so,
well,
he's so
here's
bad.
Number one. He's here. He is in Iraq today and yesterday blasting our candidates. Well, can someone explain to me why, in addition to the billions and billions of dollars we're spending in Iraq, we have now spent money to send John McCain and two of his buddies, two other senators, Joe Lieberman and Lindsey Graham, to Iraq on taxpayer dollars so that they can he can make it a campaign stop on his way to London to go to a fundraiser? That's number one.
He has a fundraiser in London?
On his way home.
I thought you weren't allowed to raise money abroad.
You can with Americans abroad. Obviously.
Oh.
But he's going to London to have a fundraiser on his way back from Iraq. It's just sort of a circuitous route, and it sort of begs the question. He's been wrong on Iraq from 2001 to 2008.